Ahmed Safi, professor at Duke University, says when it comes to U.S. relations with Muslims, even compared to the days after 9/11, America's not doing that great.
But we are today 20 points lower in how much we like Muslims. We are 20 points worse off than we were a week after 9/11. 9/11 doesn't explain it all. What has happened is that hate-mongering groups that used to be out on the fringes have now moved to the mainstream.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, Professor Safi explains how Muslims are not being understood on a local, national, or international level by most of our public officials and government. That's coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma, filling in for Ross Chambliss. Today we hear from Ahmed Safi, professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University, specializing in contemporary Islamic thought and Islamic spirituality. During this hour, he will speak about the past, national, and international relationship between the United States and the Muslim and non-white peoples in America and throughout the world. Pointing to recent trends in the presidential race, Professor Safi illustrates growing Islamophobia, moving from the fringes of the internet to overtaking the stage of the national media. This talk was recorded on April 6, 2016, at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the University of Utah campus. Professor Safi serves as the director of the Islamic Studies Center at Duke University and is chair to the Islamic Mysticism Group at the American Academy of Religion, the largest international organization devoted to academic study of religion. Professor Safi has worked on the forefront of the progressive Muslim movement since 9/11 and before. He says his movement is, quote, striving to realize a just and pluralistic society through a critical engagement with Islam, a relentless pursuit of social justice, an emphasis on gender equality as a foundation of human rights, and a vision of religious and ethnic pluralism. Here is Professor Safi.
I am delighted to have this opportunity to speak with you, and I will let you know in advance that this is not one of those rah-rah kind of speeches. This is not some political rally to remind you that we are here to make America great again, nor is it going to be a response to that by insisting that, as perhaps Secretary Clinton would have done, to say that, no, actually, America has always been great. What I'm actually here to tell you is that we as a nation are not doing particularly well. We're not doing well locally, we're not doing well nationally, and we have not been a force for what we think we have been internationally. I come out of a tradition of the civil rights movement, what we refer to as the prophetic tradition of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which starts by identifying the moral health of a community by taking a very close and unflinching look at the way within which the people who at the moment find themselves weak and vulnerable are faring. This goes back to the Gospels, according to St. Matthew, chapter 25, in which Christ says, "That which you do to the least of these, you do unto me." In other words, we do not begin by taking a look at how much wealth a society has generated, but rather we begin by taking a look at the poor, the needy, the orphan, the widow, the stranger. Right? That conglomeration is the group that in the Hebrew Bible, in the New Testament, and in the Quran, time and time and time again, is referred to as the group of people that we have to keep track of. However the poor, the needy, the orphan, the widow, the stranger are doing, that's how we stand in front of God. We like to believe that we are a good society and a just society. And yet, when we take a look at our distribution of wealth within our own society, we see America as the richest nation in the history of the planet, and the nation that currently has the greatest income disparity between the super-haves and the absolutely have-nots. Now, we cannot be both. We cannot both claim to be a nation of opportunity and lifting ourselves up by our bootstraps at a time when we have got 20% of our children living in poverty, 40% of our black children, brown children, and Native American children living in poverty. What that has to do with the conversation about Islam and Muslims is that in the aftermath of World War II, and it's not that we had an unblemished record before that time, our Native American friends, African American friends, and friends in the Philippines have a very different story to tell. But particularly in the aftermath of World War II, we have become, and I think it is way past time that we openly and unapologetically acknowledge this, we have become an empire. There have been empires in this world before, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, which embraced that title with a great deal of pride, the sun never sets on the British Empire. We as Americans are in some ways a very dangerous entity because we're an empire in denial. No other society on earth is as heavily militarized as we are. No other society devotes the level of its common goods and resources to militarism as we do. And yet when we're reminded that we've got military bases on the soil of 150 nations around the world, we act shocked. Right? We just think of ourselves as a force for good. The way that the Muslim community comes into play is that increasingly, and particularly in the aftermath of the horrific events of September the 11th, it is the Muslim majority part of the world that the military conflicts of the United States manifest themselves in. We are currently involved in bombing 7 Muslim majority society with an atrocious and bloody, devastating occupation of Iraq and a war in Afghanistan, which has neither transformed those two societies for the better, nor has it actually succeeded in making us any safer. The militarism abroad also has consequences for us at home. So much of what I'm going to be talking about is the rise in anti-Muslim bigotry in America over the last few years, where we have moved from seeing anonymous blogs speaking about Muslims in the most derogatory fashion. That point of view has now shifted front and center to the point that people running for the highest office in the land are speaking about Islam hates us, banning Muslims, doing surveillance on the places that they gather, and so on. This information is not one that's hypothetical. It's not abstract. It's not something that the discussion of it is limited to politics institutes. It has a real-life consequence for the safety, well-being, and dignity of American citizens who choose to bow before God following the path of the Prophet. And for me, this is intensely personal because the image that I'm going to start with are the image of 3 of my own students at the University of North Carolina who were shot and killed execution style in their own apartment. This is a family that I've been close to. I have eaten in their home. I prayed in their home. I know their parents. We have broken the fast of Ramadan together. And then to have to go and stand in front of 10,000 students at my university and give the eulogy for these 3 students and to try to assure them that you're still safe here and you belong here is something that drives the point home for me. I'm going to start with a reminder that if we're going to talk about Islam and America, let's not treat these two as 2 separate categories. Let's remember that there have been Muslims in America ever since Columbus sailed, got lost, and discovered this magical place. Right? There were Muslim map makers on Columbus's ship. Let's remember that when we as Americans became involved, before there was such a thing as America, when we engaged in a centuries-long practice of enslaving West African human beings, stripping them of their culture, their ethnicity, their religion in both North and South America, that 15 to 25% of those slaves, of those human beings who were enslaved, were Muslim. There have been Muslims in America since well before the overwhelming majority of European heritage Americans arrived here. And the image of someone like Malcolm X, who reminds us that America is both a dream and a nightmare, is going to be one of the running themes of our conversation. The dream is important, and as somebody who is indebted to Martin, I teach the courses on Martin Luther King on the Duke campus. I'm mindful of the fact that today is April 6th. April 4th is the high holy day of the year for me, not just because that's when Martin was shot and killed in Lorraine Motel, room 306, in the balcony, but also because a year to the day before, he gave what for me and for many of us is the most important political speech of 20th century America. We like to remember Martin in this iconic moment of triumph, standing in the heat of August on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and talking about a dream that he had had. Much less frequently do we remember that 4 years after that, on April 4th, he reluctantly stands in Riverside Church in New York, introduced by the brilliant, prophetic Jewish rabbi, Abraham Joshua Heschel. And Martin starts by saying, "I have come to this magnificent house of worship because my conscience no longer permits me to remain silent. The time comes when silence is betrayal, and for us with respect to Vietnam, that time is now." He goes on to say, "We must speak against our government when the government is wrong, but we must do so humbly, with an awareness of history." And he's a preacher who became involved in the SCLC, and their mission was to save the soul of America. That was the motto of SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Coalition. And he says, "When I look at the soul of America, our soul is sick right now. And I think we're dying. And if you do an autopsy on it, the answer is going to come back war. War killed America." And because he's a preacher and preachers make lists, he says there's such a thing called the triplet giant of evil that is hurting America. What is the triplet giant of evil? Racism, as it has always been. What does the voice of Martin, what does the prophetic tradition have to say to us today when we have not become the post-racial society that we thought we were becoming in the election of President Obama? So much so that black folk in this country need to be leading a movement, Black Lives Matter, with a simple request: stop killing black people. Do that. Martin says we've become a thing-centered society. What would he have to say to us today? And the third one is militarism. Militarism, which is not just war. It is the war machinery. It is the operation that necessitates war to keep it running. And we have been in continuous military conflict somewhere in the world ever since World War II. When Martin stands and he gives this talk, he's already the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., period. He's already the guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's already been invited to the White House, but how is he received? The New York Times talks about King's error. The FBI calls him the most dangerous man in America. The NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, says, "We talk about race, Martin. Why are you dragging war into it?" The Washington Post calls him a demagogue and someone who has outlived his usefulness to his people and to America. Martin dies, Martin is killed, with 72% of Americans disapproving of him. We don't tell that Martin story. I travel around the country, and when I ask people how many people have ever read the Riverside Church speech, I get 2% of hands going up. That's not an accident. We want to see this Martin. We want to have the I Have a Dream in your social studies courses, but a Martin that connects the racism in America to the militarism abroad is a threatening Martin. It's a dangerous Martin. It's a Martin that we don't want to touch. I want us to talk about how the American civil rights movement starts when Mamie Till makes the extraordinary bold decision to bury her son Emmett in an open casket funeral when he's been dragged out of bed in the middle of the night by three white terrorists who beat him so savagely that his head is five times the size of what it had been the day before. And her response is, I'm going to put my baby in the soil, but not until the 10,000 people that have lined up outside the church in Chicago see what these white terrorists did to my baby. I'm going to keep the casket open. I'm going to weep and mourn in public, but I don't have a minute to hate. I'm going to dedicate myself to love and justice. It's that bold decision to speak your truth and let your suffering become public that is the launching moment of the American Civil Rights Movement. That is what Rosa Parks says she was thinking of when she makes the bold decision to stand up by sitting down. And that is what we see in the American Muslim community.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. That was Professor Ahmed Safi discussing the civil rights movement and how it created the stage for our current political and religious landscape. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we're airing a talk given on April 6, 2016, by Professor Ahmed Safi about the status of the Muslim world in America and how it has developed since Columbus sailed to America in 1492, accompanied by a Muslim navigator.
We've had 15 years of American Muslim organizations hating and condemning 9/11, hating and condemning every terrorist activity. I sometimes joke with people to say we should just have an app that we develop, the Hate and Condemn app. We just push a button and it releases the press release, right? We as American Muslims deplore this hateful action. These actions in no way are representative of the highest ideals of Islam. The Muslim community of blank hates and condemns this terrorist activity. Please don't deport us. We've said this. We've said this over and over and over and over again. I personally sent a 200-page packet of press releases from every American Muslim organization since 9/11 to Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. Because ever since 9/11, he's like, why can't I hear the American Muslims? Right? At some point, it's not that we as Muslims are not speaking. It's that you're not listening. And we have to ask the question, why aren't you listening? Why are we as an American community so inclined to think that our own citizens are either cowards or perhaps secretly in support of these vile terrorist actions? What changed so much of the narrative was this extraordinary Arab-American Muslim woman, a Syrian background, American Muslim, born and raised in America, one of my students. I adored her when she was 18. I'm in awe of her now that she's 28. She graduated from my former University of North Carolina, went on to become a physician, and is now serving an underprivileged, largely HIV-positive community in San Francisco. She's working the night shift, and her phone blows up, people saying, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, offering condolences about the fact that her brother has been shot and killed execution style. She gets on a plane, takes the red eye, gets in North Carolina, and there is a press conference. That's her father and that's her mother flanking her. They are too shattered to speak. She steps up to the podium and she says, I'm sorry that I'm going to have a hard time speaking. I'm spending every last ounce of energy that I have holding myself together. But I am more than this tragedy. There is a love that my mama put into my bones. There is a faith that my parents raised me with. And I'm going to lean on my faith in God to have something to say. Let me tell you what it's like for me as a sister, but also as a physician, to read the autopsy report of how this killer put bullets in the back of my brother's head and blew out his midsection of his brain. Let me tell you what that does to me as an American and as a Muslim. Her voice quivering and standing solid. That moment of extraordinary suffering made public did more to change people's perception of Islam than a million press releases, a million interfaith conversations had ever done. Because what people saw was a deep humanity that they recognized as their own. We shouldn't have to have people mourning their three loved ones, but this ability to stand quivering and shaking and yet anchored in the faith and love that makes you human was an extraordinary moment of transformation. I want to make sure that we talk about not just Islamophobia, but ISIS. Being a Muslim, we are charged with a moral mandate to begin the task of critique with ourselves. There is a level of butchery, savagery, that ISIS is engaged in that we have simply not seen before. They keep having to lower and lower and lower the moral bar, going from beheadings to the burning of people alive. And a couple of months ago, they had, I think, an 8-year-old boy beheading his own mother. Now, I keep being asked by people, how consistent is ISIS with the values of Islam? And I just want to tell them, if you knew anything about Islam, you would know that the dignity of a human being is more holy than the Kaaba in Mecca, according to the Prophet. If you knew anything about Islam, when the Prophet is asked, of all the people on earth, whom should I serve? And he says, your mama. And people say, well, after my mama. He's like, your mama, again. Okay, after my mama, your mama. 3 times he answers, your mother, and only then your father, and then the rest of humanity. And then you're seeing someone behead his own mother, and you're asking me how this is consistent with the values of Islam? Right? The same Abraham Joshua Heschel that introduces King has an extraordinary saying that I always come back to. It's the title of one of my columns about ISIS. He says, few are guilty, all are responsible. ISIS is guilty. But it's not American Muslims or the worldwide Muslim community that's responsible. We as a human community are responsible. And we as Americans have a moral responsibility in having created the chaotic situation in Iraq in which ISIS flourishes. There was no ISIS before we went to Iraq. Heck, there was even no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before we went there. As I've said elsewhere, we have to also recognize that if we want to understand ISIS, it's not enough just to say which Islamic texts are they drawing from when we know that they're theologically illiterate. The prisoners of ISIS tell us we couldn't even find a copy of the Quran among them. The 1 or 2 Americans who've volunteered to go fight for ISIS, the day before they leave, they're ordering a book from Amazon, and this tells you everything you need to know. The Complete Idiot's Guide to Islam. Okay, you're a complete idiot And if that's what you need to read to learn Islam 101, right, then we know where we stand. But we also know that the cinematography, the aesthetic, the movie production of ISIS videos are directly shaped after the American horror movie tradition. We know that ISIS is sending out 80,000 tweets a day. And when I get summoned by the American State Department to advise them on how to fight ISIS, their response is, they're out-technologying us. We don't know how to compete with them on social media. So if you want to understand them, don't think that you need to read books of medieval Islamic theology. They are the dark monster of modernity. A question that I want to keep asking us is, when ISIS sends one of their horrific beheading videos, it gets shared on social media tens of millions of times. It goes on permanent rotation on Fox News. When on the other hand, we have every significant American, Arab, Iranian, Turkish, South Asian, African, Muslim leader issuing statements, taking apart the arguments of ISIS and proving once and for all definitively how they're in violation of normative Islamic legal and theological rulings, it's never covered. There's a website, multiple languages. You can go and check it out. Open letter to al-Baghdadi. ISIS is guilty. Few are guilty. The question that I want to ask is, where is our responsibility? Not only in having created the chaos out of which ISIS flourishes, where is our responsibility in giving the platform that ISIS craves but does not deserve? They are so desperate to wrap themselves in a mantle of Islamic authority when they have none. Why do we give it to them? Why do we treat them exactly as what they want, a representation of Islam? And then, why do we turn a blind eye towards the religious scholars and leaders who are actually speaking out against ISIS? Here's perhaps the most influential American Muslim leader, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, who has a specific Friday sermon talking about the crisis of ISIS. Every North American Muslim knows or should know about this. It got practically zero coverage. This is a guy that when he goes to our Muslim conferences, he's like the great white hope of Islam. Like 50,000 people fill a conference hall just to hear this guy breathe. And we can't get CNN to even cover his denunciation of ISIS. That says nothing about Hamza Yusuf. It says a lot about CNN. Let's talk about a little bit of in terms of where we are as a country, where we've got someone like Trump, and it is an honor to share the podium of where Governor Romney called him out for what he is. I never thought I would actually compliment Governor Romney in that particular sense, but we found common cause in this issue. What does it mean when you've got someone who speaks about banning Muslim immigrants? And let's just be clear for a second about what we're talking about. In the Syrian crisis, we're talking about one of the largest human rights catastrophes of our lifetime. We're talking about the single largest refugee crisis since World War II. 6 million and counting today. Half of an entire country, which was a cornerstone of Arab civilization going back 10,000 years, have been made refugees. And we as a country are having a debate whether to take 10,000 out of 6 million. Mind you, not by taking 10,000 extra. We're actually keeping the total number of immigrants we would take the same. We just turned down 10,000 African or Myanmar refugees, and maybe we would take 10,000 of the Syrians. Those 10,000, Donald Trump would ban. Jeb Bush, who was one of the sane voices on the Republican side, would have said, we'll take them as long as they're Christian. Because, of course, we as Americans know to impose religious tests on a people who are fleeing persecution is something that's got a few echoes in our own history. How do I make it, as Malcolm would have said, how do I make it plain to you? The 6 million people who are leaving their ancestral homeland where their grandparents' bones are, where they were loved into becoming who they are, they are fleeing that country because they're caught up between two genocidal forces. As I call them, the dogs of hell that are ISIS on one hand, and the genocidal butcher who is Bashar al-Assad on the other. The 6 million people fleeing Syria are the victims of terrorism. Donald Trump and virtually the entire GOP is treating them as agents of terrorism. Like, can we actually sit with the horror of treating the victim of a crime as the perpetrator of a crime? Where is our outrage? Where is our morality? Where are our journalists who will raise a hand and say, Mr. Trump, these are innocent, unarmed civilians, the majority of them women and children, fleeing ISIS and Assad. Why are you treating them like terrorists? Trump is calling about registering Muslims in ways that should send shivers down and up our spine when we think about registering of Jews in the 1930s Germany. But it's not just Trump. Ted Cruz, who's probably going to get the fight in the GOP that he wanted, is equally atrocious. Rubio talked about shutting down any place that Muslims gather. Right? I suppose that includes every cafe, every shisha joint, every falafel shop, and shawarma shop. And back when he was running, Ben Carson talked about Muslims being disqualified from the presidency. Now, I'm just a nerdy little professor not running for political office, but somewhere we read that the government of the United States of America shall never establish religious qualifications as a test of holding political office. This is on page one of our founding documents. I'm sorry, if you flunk social studies, you don't get to run for presidency. If you don't know chemistry, you don't get to be our chief chemist. And if you don't know our American Constitution, you don't get to represent it and defend it. Not only that, you don't get to run for political office if you compare the victims of ISIS, the victims of Assad, and you call them rabid dogs. And if you know your history, you would remember the way that Jewish refugees were called mice, diseased animals, back in the 1930s. If they don't know their history, we do, and we will have to insist on it. Every time they make these comments, the donations to them go up. The real crisis is not Trump, Rubio, Carson, Cruz. The real crisis are the tens of thousands of people applauding them wildly and donating to their campaigns and voting for them. We as Americans have a bigotry crisis. We're going to have to come to terms with it, or it is going to erode and undermine our fledgling American democratic experiment. When we think about this fear-mongering that's going on, we have to think about where it's coming from. Is it just a fear of terrorism? Yeah, I've got kids. I'm afraid of something happening to my babies. They are the love of my life. It's the heart that is inside my heart, leaping out of my chest, and I see them walk around every day. I'm a pacifist, nonviolent person until something happens to my babies, right? Brother Malcolm said, I'm a perfectly nonviolent person until you touch me. Then I'll put you in the cemetery. I get that, really. Pacifist nonviolent until you touch my baby. Right? Then all bets are off. Understand wanting to protect your loved ones. If you really want to protect your loved ones from domestic terrorism, I tell you who you should be on guard for. Crazy white people. Armed groups of crazy white men. 18 to 25 years old. I don't know what it is with them. You look at school shootings, church shootings. The overwhelming majority of domestic acts of terrorism are committed by young, alienated, gun-obsessed American white men. But whether it's Aurora or Dylan Roof walking into the historic AME church in Charleston, who even does you the service of putting his hate on his personal blog, "I hate black people. I hate black people when they touch our white women. I hate blacks. Did I mention that I hate blacks? Here's my personal manifesto of how much I hate blacks. KKK." And then he goes and he kills 9 people after they have taken him into their church and prayed with his sorry ass self. How do we treat him? "Oh, he was just a terribly sad person, mentally disturbed." We know there's no correlation between mental illness and violence. The only time that these folks seem to care about the mentally ill is when some white guy kills people. Then all of a sudden they all care about the mentally ill. And we treat him as a lone wolf. When a Muslim does a domestic act of terrorism, like San Bernardino, then we get 4 days wall-to-wall on Fox, ISIS in America. Culture of death. What is it about Islam that produces these terrorists? Have you ever seen a title, "What is it about white people culture"? Never. Never. Because they're just lone wolves. When a Muslim does it, culture of death. And then a week later, "Oh, so sorry. We have found actually there was no correlation between San Bernardino and ISIS. Our bad." The threat of ISIS is real. Their savagery is real. Let's remember who their primary victims are. Muslims. Yes, they persecute Christians and Yazidis, destroying monuments. The primary people they kill are Muslims. Is it about 9/11? 9/11 was an assault on America, on our political and economic institutions. But we are today 20 points lower in how much we like Muslims. We are 20 points worse off than we were a week after 9/11. 9/11 doesn't explain it all. What has happened is that hate-mongering groups that used to be out on the fringes have now moved to the mainstream. Like Frank Gaffney on the right, they're now listed as the foreign policy advisor of Ted Cruz. Or on the left, Daniel Pipes, they get to be on Fox News day and night. They are writing state legislation on banning the Sharia.
That was Professor Ahmed Safi explaining how the presidential race has shown a growing acceptance of Islamophobia in the political world and its repercussions for Muslim Americans and our international policies. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Now we will return to Professor Ahmed Safi's speech focused on the changing landscape of Muslims in America and how he says hate-mongering has brought Islamophobia into the public sphere, and how this, in turn, has shaped our foreign policy.
In a nutshell, I would say that the policies of the United States towards the Muslim majority world have never been the promotion of freedom, liberty, and democracy. We like to think that we are this beacon of good. What we have actually done is to favor and empower dictators with atrocious records of treating their own population on human rights levels, who then turn around, sell us cheap oil, and buy military hardware from us. Here is the Iranian prime minister who nationalized Iranian oil, the victim of a coup d'etat in 1953 from the CIA. In his place, we put the Shah of Iran that in the early 1970s was called the person with the worst human rights record in the world. Not surprisingly, Iranians rise up not just against him, but also against America. They take over the U.S. embassy and burn our flag. In Egypt, we had a 30-year policy of supporting Hosni Mubarak and now his clone, General Sisi. Both of them, atrocious record of imprisoning people, torturing people. Donald Rumsfeld going to Iraq and shaking the bloody hand of Saddam Hussein after Saddam had already used chemical weapons on his own people. What do we even say about Israel? Our closest ally, Republican and Democratic side, who are engaged in a 67-year occupation of the West Bank in ways that when South African Nobel Peace Prize-winning people like Desmond Tutu arrive there, they say, we grew up under apartheid. What's going on in Palestine is apartheid. And our only response to it is, la, 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 if you call it that, it's anti-Semitism. You occupy people, you treat them as second-class citizens, you have Jews-only settlements, Jews-only highways. What do you want us to call it? And we give more foreign aid to Israel than we give to the rest of the planet combined. We have to speak the truth, know our facts, speak humbly, but be consistent. This is what is left of Palestine, Israel. This is what is left of the West Bank, not including the Jews-only illegal settlements. You're looking at the future of what is supposed to be the two-state solution. There is no two-state solution. The two-state solution died when 250,000 illegal settlement Jews went to live there on occupied territories. The whole rest of the planet calls them illegal. What do we say about Iraq? What do we say about Iraq when we forgot about the entire people of Iraq and treated them under the rubric of Saddam Hussein equal Hitler? Saddam Hussein was a bloodthirsty dictator. This guy who chops up his own son-in-law, puts him in a suitcase. Does that justify imposing a sanctions on Iraq that lead to the death of 1 million people, most of them children? It's not just a Republican issue. Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State under the Clinton administration, is asked, Madam Secretary, the American-led sanctions up until that day have resulted in the death of 600,000 children. Do you think this is a price worth paying? And her response is, yes. Yes. Who speaks for these dead children? What do we do when the images that go into our history books are actually American staged events with American tanks around the circle, American buses bussing in people, and American cranes bringing down the statue of Saddam? We produce the images that then comfort us that the people of Iraq rose up and toppled their hated dictator. This is not an appreciation of Saddam Hussein. This is calling out the political machinery of the United States, erasing the atrocities of a war. And then our president goes on TV and talking about the great respect that we have for Iraqi civilization when we protected every last oil field in Iraq, but failed to protect the national and international heritage of not just Iraqi civilization, but human civilization. The first human alphabet, our first cities, our first codes of government, they were all in Iraqi museums. 200 scholars, me being one of them, sent all of that information to the Bush administration. We left that unprotected. We put our soldiers around the oil fields. Now tell me, how is that respect for the civilization of Iraq? And then he gets to fly a mission, talking about mission accomplished. What do we do when our official army policy is we don't do body counts, but when journalists counted, they found 122,000 dead Iraqis as a result of the American occupation, and International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War estimates the number to have been 1.3 million. We see these horrific images coming out of the Iraqi prisons, sexual humiliation in Abu Ghraib. And just like Dylan Loof, when we see these images, the response is, oh, they're just a few bad apples. There's no policy. It doesn't go up the chain of command. This doesn't happen without a concurrent dehumanization of Iraqi humans, Muslim humans. We have Guantanamo, where for 15 years we've been holding people without charging them with a crime or letting them come up to a trial. We force feed them twice a day rather than letting them face a day in court. What to even say about drones when operators in Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico get to decide who lives and who dies in seven Muslim countries? Children being droned to death. One estimate alone in Pakistan alone talks about as many as 3,600 people being droned. What do we do when wedding parties have been droned to death? Their blood is on our hands. We are responsible. Few are guilty. We are responsible. What do we do when we've got Pakistani grandmothers being obliterated and when their family shows up in D.C., not a single American congressman shows up to meet with them? Not a Republican, not a Democrat. Instead, we have congressional hearings on radicalization in the Muslim community. We see the rates of hatred and bigotry towards Muslims ever increasing. And it's like watching some virus spread across America. These are activities and demonstrations in front of mosques. We got preachers in America like Franklin Graham. We're arresting our Muslim high school students because they build clocks and we think they must be bomb makers. We've got white separatist, KKK, neo-Nazi-style folk having open carry demonstrations, showing up with AK-47s in front of American mosques. 21 simultaneous one single Friday last August. And according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, one of the most reputable organizations for tracking hate groups, this is the map of America with 784 hate organizations, the majority of them neo-Nazis, white separatist groups. Where's our national conversation on that? This is the domestic terrorism crisis. In the meantime, we're not dealing with the refugee crisis. We're not talking about the millions of refugees that are created. We're not talking about the rising wave of bigotry against Muslims in Europe. We're not talking about the destruction that has taken place in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is Aleppo. Every now and then, we pause to notice the bodies of dead children washing up on the shores of Turkey and Greece. There is still something that can be done. This image, which captured so many people's imagination, of the Syrian dad grabbing his daughter, fortunately, they survived and were resettled. It is not too late to do something. Let me end by just saying that this is not just about militarism there. but it's also about something that's eroding our democratic experiment here. The weaponry that we developed to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan is now being sold back to American inner cities. So this is Ferguson. This is not your grandparents' police force, but people wearing military-grade SWAT equipment targeting primarily black and brown people. Sometimes you have to even pause and figure out which one is Palestine and which one is Ferguson. And it's no surprise because the exact same tear gas is used on all of these populations. So much so that the people of Gaza were tweeting at the people of Ferguson, this is how you wash your eyes out with milk when they use tear gas on you. We're seeing the emergence of a model of solidarity where Muslims, African Americans, gays and lesbians, women's groups, environmental groups, poor people's groups are bonding together in a notion of solidarity. My only hope for the redemption of the American experiment is the way that we saw towards the end of Martin's life, that we would see people who would connect together the suffering here to the suffering there, who would form broad coalitions of solidarity and insist that we cannot be who we want to be until you be who you ought to be.
We're wrapping up this talk here. If you'd like to hear the full talk by Professor Ahmed Safi, you can find it on our website at kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute Wayne Owens Fund. I'm your host, Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.